Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's a couple of seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. And it's time for Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. Got a great lineup of guests for you. Well, we're going to be hearing about the UAS Sound and Motion series. Katie Bosler is going to drop in to tell us about that. Dennis Mamana is in town. He's going to do the weekend's planetarium guest speaker bit. He's going to deliver his Seven Wonders of the Cosmos lecture at the Marie Drake Planetarium. Friday's fireside lecture is Bill Hurd. He's going to be talking about Chinook salmon, Alaska state fish, and we'll be talking with members of Rumblefish. They're redoing or replaying their music alongside fabulous General. The General is playing at Goldtown Theater, and they're going to be providing background music. Right now it's time for National Native News, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal representatives are gathered in Rapid City, South Dakota, to brainstorm ways to battle Keystone XL. The proposed pipeline would carry crude oil from Canada to the U.S. and travel through western South Dakota, skirting reservation land. As Victoria Wicks reports, Indigenous people view all of western South Dakota as Indian country outlined in the Fort Laramie Treaty and say they should decide how the land is used.
Environmental leaders say the Keystone XL pipeline threatens water purity. It's designed to cross under several rivers and streams, including the Missouri River, and if it breaks, it will contaminate drinking water on reservations. The solution, they say, is to stop the pipeline. Oglala Sioux Tribal President Brian Brewer says he and leaders of other tribes are going to try to set up a government-to-government meeting. Brewer says the State Department sent low-level employees to Rapid City last year to meet with tribes, so he and other leaders walked out.
We're going to ask for a real consultation nation to nation, and that's where our treaties are set up. So we're going to ask for an audience with President Obama or with John Kerry.
The Keystone XL pipeline violates the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. Accordingly, it is not in the national interest of the United States.
Phyllis Young serves on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council. She says the tribe has pointed out to the U.S. State Department that the pipeline will increase greenhouse gas emissions, causing climate change that affects the tribes. Young says Standing Rock proposes charging TransCanada hundreds of millions of dollars to run the line through western South Dakota. But Oglala Lakota activist Deborah Whiteplume says talk of money is unacceptable.
I don't care if it's $1.5 million a mile, like some tribes are calling for. To the Oglala, that's treason. And we're going to treat it like treason because our tribe said no.
Earlier this year, the U.S. State Department released the finding that the pipeline will not increase carbon emissions because the world will burn Alberta tar sands crude even if the pipeline is not built. That decision moved the pipeline a step closer to approval. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
U.S. Montana Senator John Tester is the new chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He assumes the gavel from Washington Senator Maria Cantwell, who moves to chair a different committee. Jackie Yamanaka reports.
The Democrat is moving quickly to reach out to tribal leaders from across the country, and he plans to start with Montana's tribes. He says as the new chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, he plans to pick up the pace on the panel's work. This includes holding hearings on bills that have already passed the House.
We're going to take a look at those and see if we can get those through the Senate. And then there's the big issues. There's the big issues about, you know, health care. You know, the Indian Health Care Improvement Act is in the Affordable Health Care Act. A lot of folks out there want to see the Affordable Health Care Act repealed. We're going to have to make sure we educate folks, not only pass policy, but educate folks. And then there's water issues. There's crime, housing, education.
Tester is a former teacher. He says he'll seek more ways to improve tribal schools and tribal colleges. Part of that effort is to preserve tribal languages. Next week, he's to visit the Crow Tribe's Head Start Language Immersion Program in South Central Montana. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley vetoed a bill this week aimed at collecting taxes from junk food. Shelley cited concerns about funding and regulation. Health advocates who backed the bill celebrated its passage in January as a way to help improve the health of Navajo people and address diet-related diseases. The bill aimed at adding taxes on sweetened beverages and snacks like chips and candy. On this day in 1931, Canyon de Chelly National Monument was established in Arizona. It's comprised entirely on Navajo Trust land and remains home to residents within the canyons. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org.
Join us for Kawanic's 2014 Alaska Native Art Auction, Thursday, February 20th in Anchorage, Alaska. Ticket and reservation information is available by going to nativeartauction.org. Proceeds benefit National Native News.
Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first guests today are Steve Kosius, who everybody knows from the Marie Drake Planetarium, and after as many appearances as he's done here, I think everyone also knows Dennis Lamana, who's in town to deliver one of his fabulous lectures on his way up to Fairbanks to show people how to photograph the Northern Lights. Welcome to back to Juneau.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you were here last year and had a sellout crowd over at the planetarium, I think.
I was, and you can't keep me away.
Yeah, yeah. So you're doing two shows, one tonight and one tomorrow night, right?
We're doing two. One tonight and one tomorrow night, and tomorrow all day. I have a full-day workshop for people as well. But the public program's tonight and tomorrow night.
Okay, and so what are we going to see tonight?
Well, tonight I'm doing a program I'm calling Flying Blue Marble. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show how, even though we feel like we're sitting perfectly still here, everything seems to be just absolutely at a standstill. The Earth is actually moving in seven different directions at more than a million miles an hour. And I'm going to go through all of those. And let me just say it's a program that will definitely leave your head spinning.
I would imagine from that multidimensional approach to the thing. So, Steve, are you doing a presentation in the process as well? Are you going to narrate the night sky like you usually do?
Yeah, I'll do that. And we're just pleased to have Dennis here as a guest, and we're quite fortunate in Juneau to have the largest planetarium in both the state of Alaska and Washington State.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you use the planetarium in your presentation?
For my presentation, I probably will not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you bring your own stuff.
Bring my own stuff, yeah.
Now, you've been doing this for a while. I think almost four decades of photographing the night sky.
And yes, 47, 48 years I've been doing it. My first published photos of the night sky came in April of 1968. So it's been, and that was a local publication, but still, I was 16 years old, and it was a lunar eclipse, and I got better photographs than our newspaper photographer, so that started me off.
And so you looked at it in print, and you thought, that's something to do, huh?
I thought, hey, I can do this. Uh-huh. This isn't too bad.
And turned it into a career.
So I did.
You go all over the world giving these talks and lectures and showing people how to photograph the night sky and like that.
I do. I work with a tour company in San Jose, California. I've been working with them for 20 years, and we take people on trips around the world for the aurora borealis, for comets, for total solar eclipses. It's really been quite fun to be able to travel as well as do my passion.
Now, you do a lot of work out in the Southwest deserts because of the clear skies.
Well, right? I live out in Borrego Springs, California, which mm-hmm. is the only internationally designated dark sky community in California. And we do have a marvelous night sky out there, and we get people from all over coming out to see the night sky, and it's one of the things that I enjoy showing them.
Can you talk about that dark sky community? What does that mean?
Well, that's the designation by the International Dark Sky Association, which is headquartered in Tucson, Arizona, an organization of lighting engineers and astronomers who are concerned with keeping the lights down on the ground where they belong instead of scattering them all over the place and wasting money and everything else. And they have a program called the International Dark Sky Community Program, and we were the second ever to get that designation back in 2009, and we're still the only one in California. There's four in the world at this point.
So how do they keep the light down?
Well, we just don't have any light where we are. We have a grand total of 25 street lights. Most of our advertising light is either shielded or it's just non-existent. And our light pollution comes mainly from car headlights. It's very, very dark where we are. We're in the middle of a 1,000 square mile, about 1,000 square miles of desert, surrounded on three sides by mountains. But on the other side of the mountains, we have Palm Springs, we have San Diego, we have Oceanside, we have Los Angeles.
So you see some glow from that.
We see glow from that, but we don't produce any light pollution. So we have a really, really dark sky in the middle of Southern California.
Somebody just published a picture on I think it was on Facebook of Alaska from space, and the caption underneath it was, "We don't use much electricity," because basically it was Anchorage, and then there was a little splash up where Fairbanks was, and they didn't get down to southeast. Yeah. The picture was taken, was cut off about a little north of Yakutat. But the other place that had a few lights glowing was Barrow.
Barrow, really? Yeah. I mean, what about the oil fields in Prudhoe Bay?
I think that was probably what I was looking at, was lights on the oil fields.
Yeah,
but it was right up there on the north coast.
Exactly.
And that was it. And the rest of the state is completely dark. So maybe you need to relocate.
Well, maybe so. And coming up to Alaska wouldn't be a bad idea for me.
Well, you do some marvelous stuff with the Northern Lights photography, and you've been doing that for a long, long time. So you're going up to Fairbanks from here. Assuming that we had a night down here when we had Northern Lights that were visible, and I know this is the business of your day-long workshop, and I don't want to cut into that because you've got students who are paying to have the instruction. But can you give us just a tip? I mean, what if I were going to go out to the glacier, which is where everybody goes, to get away from almost any light whatsoever around here, what should I do?
Well, to photograph the Northern Lights, assuming people in Juneau certainly have seen them, so they know how they behave, you have to have a manual camera that you can set manually. You have to have it on a tripod. And you have to be able to focus your camera on infinity, because that's basically where these things are. They're off at infinity. That's not as trivial a problem as one might think it is. It's a rather difficult thing to do. And I spend quite a bit of time in my workshop, in fact, actually talking about focus. And then the trick really is take photographs, and if you have a digital camera, you have the advantage of looking at the LCD screen and seeing what the picture looks like. So you take the picture, you look at it. If it's what you want, you're okay. My recommendation, though, is if it's too bright, make some changes manually to darken it. And if it's too dark, make some changes to brighten it. But one of the things that I see a lot, even after my programs, is people will go out and take one picture and they'll either be satisfied or dissatisfied. Keep experimenting. You can always hit the delete button. It's free.
Is it necessary to have an SLR camera? Or can you do this?
No, not at all. No. Very small point-and-shoot cameras. I've taken some of my best photographs with these little point-and-shoot cameras. As long as you have the capability of doing it manually, setting your focus and your aperture and your speed, if you can set all those things manually and you have control of it rather than some faceless box inside of the camera, if you have control over it, you can do it, even if it's a point-and-shoot, sure.
And so in your day-long workshop on Saturday now, you're going to actually take people, have them bring their cameras in, and you're going to show them how you set everything up and how to run the camera manually and like that.
I've got the program basically broken into four segments. Before you go out to photograph, while you're out photographing, and then what do you do after you photograph? Because that's kind of important. It's actually maybe the most important thing. Uh-huh. And then I'm going to spend a little time on some of the celestial events that are coming up this year that people can photograph, some of the great celestial photo ops. So it's a full day, and people will hopefully have, I've got some folks that are coming back from last year's workshop, so hopefully they'll get a little bit more this year.
Now, Steve, where will those be held?
This will all be at the Redirect Planetarium, which is downtown Glacier Avenue, right behind the artificial turf field.
Okay, so tonight's program, the blue ball, and the program that's the day-long workshop on Saturday are both in Marie Drake.
Well, there's actually three programs. Tonight's show at 7 p.m. is at the Planetarium.
Okay.
The workshop, which is all day, is at the Planetarium. And tomorrow evening's show is at the Planetarium. So the two evening shows are both at 7 p.m., Friday evening, 7 p.m., and Saturday evening, 7 p.m.
Outstanding. There's a fee for the workshops, right? The day-long workshop?
Yes. It's $99 for the full day.
Right. Okay. But the two planetarium shows, of course, are free, right?
No. Well, the two planetarium shows, we're charging $5 for people over 18 to pay some of the expenses of bringing Dennis here.
And,
Normally our shows are free, that's true.
Yeah, normally they are, yeah. Okay, good enough. Well, hey, outstanding. Thank you so much for making the trip. Good luck when you take off from here and fly up to the frigid north and get to, I hope you have clear days and clear skies up there.
Oh, I hope so,
and
too.
I'm assuming that the two of you are conspiring to try to get the clouds to lift so that we can actually rush around here and get some pictures of the...
I don't have friends in high places.
Solar activity
with
tonight.
All of the years that you've been taking pictures of high places, one would think you would have made some friends by now, Dennis.
You would think, wouldn't you?
Dennis Mamana going to be at the Marie Dick Planetarium tonight, 7:30?
7 p.m. tonight.
7 p.m. tonight. Oh, yeah. And then all day Saturday, the workshop. If they want to sign up, do they just show up, or is there someone you need
you
to call?
You can show up at the door.
Okay, show up at the door for the workshop and learn how to shoot the night sky. Hey, welcome back to Juneau.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, Pat.
From an album called The Mighty Sky and the marvelous collection of songs about the universe there. And tonight and tomorrow, Dennis Mamana's in town, going to do some shows over at Marie Dick Planetarium, so plan on taking in one of those if you can. A couple of announcements having to do with the fact that it's snowing like crazy out there, and it's probably going to turn to rain later this afternoon. And then tonight it's going to be windy with rain and snow in the evening, and a chance of, maybe rain late with snow accumulations up to maybe another inch. And that's caused a number of things, not quite related to the weather, but due to an emergency, the pool at... the pool at Diamond Park Aquatic Center is closed until 9 o'clock Saturday morning. So if you were planning on going to the pool this evening, that's not going to happen. Additionally, we are in the midst of snow relocations, so the Capital Transit is implementing winter route changes until midnight tonight. Services discontinued at St. Anne's Avenue, Cordova Street, Davis Avenue, Lemon Creek Road, and Franklin and 4th Streets downtown. There is no service on Cordova Street, no service at St. Anne's, no service on Franklin or 4th Street, and no service on Davis Avenue and Lemon Creek Road for Capital Transit. And Docks and Harbors Department is asking that all boat owners go down and check their vessels' mooring lines, bilges, pumps, and tarps. We've got a lot of snow built up on the boats, and if you have one parked down in one of the harbors, this would be a really good afternoon to drift down there with a snow shovel and make sure that everything is cleared off so that it doesn't collapse under the weight or have some other nasty little mishap like that. So, my next guest is a frequent appearance on the show here, and we get to talk about these wonderful things that go on around town that are all centered around UAS. Katie Bosler's here, and she's going to tell us about a number of things. Katie, I understand we're coming up on, tonight, no, next weekend is Woosh Kanati out at the university, the Sound and Motion show.
We're really excited, Pat, that we're having the second now annual Sound in Motion appearance of the Woosh K Poetry Slam. This is, of course, a roaring success. It's going on, been going on for 3 or 4 years now. And this is an event where the public, anyone really who wants to participate in open mic, is invited for the first part to share a poem, or if you're a singer-songwriter, a song. And then after that, there is a competitive poetry slam where people bring three pieces of original poetry and compete. So last year we had it at the Egan Lecture Hall, and it was a great success. This year we're going for the UAS Rec Center. Now that's the joint use facility that we share with the National Guard along just right across from what is now the main entrance to UAS. Used to be the back entrance, and you'll see a big sign there that says UAS Rec Center. Just kind of go up and down the hill there, and it's a really great venue. Great sound. And it's also very comfortable seating. So the way it's going to work is, if you want to participate in the open mic or the slam, you show up at 6:30. The show begins at 7. And performers of all types are encouraged to take part in this non-competitive part, the open mic. And, of course, the original poetry is welcome in the slam. And the MCs, we're very excited about, are UAS alumni, or alum, I should say, Colin Kalk. He is a very recent graduate of UAS and a great writer, English major. And DJ Durego, and the sacrificial poet. And that's somebody who kind of, you know... starts things rolling, is just an awesome poet, slam poet, UAS student, and he is the January Woosh K Slam champion, Nathan Block.
And you say sacrificial because his entry will not be judged in the competition.
Yeah, okay. I think it's kind of like the forerunner in a ski race.
yeah. Test out the slope.
Yeah, sure. So, we're, again, Woosh K is next Friday, a week from tonight, February 21st, UAS Rec Center, 6:30 sign up, 7 o'clock it starts. And I think the Woosh K people will be on next week to give more details about this, but I just kind of was going to give people a heads up. And also just let people know that the Sound in Motion Spring Art Series is on at UAS. It's a little different from Evening at Egan because it's not every Friday, but it's many Fridays throughout the spring. So just to give you kind of a quick overview, the 14th of March, we'll have a kickoff to an Alaska Native Studies conference. This is a 3-day gathering of Alaska Native Studies faculty and students from all over Alaska with a focus on indigenous cultural and language education. They'll be doing some kind of, I think, music event, probably at the library on the Friday the 14th. The 25th is now, I think, the 5th annual Treasures from the State Film Library. Really psyched about that, where Damon Stubner from the Alaska State Library Historical Collection comes in, and he's going to be focusing on the 50th anniversary of the Alaskan earthquake that kind of centered near Anchorage. On one of the selections will include Though the Earth Be Moved. It's a documentary from way back then. And then in April, mark your calendars, first Friday, the 4th, will again be at the Rec Center, and it'll be a photo presentation discussion from A Trip South. This is the gang who took off June 1st, 2012. They're not all back yet, including my son. Kanan and Andrew Flanzis are still on the road, as it were. They're down along the Chilean archipelago, but there'll be a number of people who participated in both the kayak and the bike parts of that expedition giving a presentation at the Rec Center April 4th. Then April 18th will be John Marzleff, who is an author and expert on crows and ravens, will be back in town for a Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. That's at the Egan Library. And our final event of the Sound and Motion series will be April 25th. That'll be the Tidal Echoes launch, and that is our literary and art journal that showcases the art and writing of Southeast. And this year the featured author is Kristi Name Erickson, who founded the Poetry Slam, amazing poet. And a feature artist will be Rachel Julizer. So if you want the details about Sound in Motion, just go to uas.alaska.edu/sound_motion, or just go to the UAS website, Google Sound in Motion. We have our own Google search within UAS, and you can find out all about it, or just go to the Juno page. It's right there.
Even though all of these programs are so wonderful, there's still no charge for the public to attend,
correct,
right? So everything that we've talked about is available free, and those are all on Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
So good chance for everybody to get out. And again, down at the Rec Center, which is shared with the National Guard as an armory down there.
Right, right. Yeah, so we're doing more and more events at the Rec Center, including, again, for those of you just tuning in, the Woosh K Poetry Slam a week from tonight, the 21st, sign up 6:30 and starts at 7.
But wait, there's more.
Exactly. There's always more. Because the thing about, you know, working in an academic institution is everything happens at once. And so we have a lot going on. I want to remind people, I know that we've had our UAS Drama Club has been here to talk about their spring production called The Country Club. But it opens tonight, actually, for a 6 total run. So it's going to be 7:30 tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday, and then next weekend, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, again, 7:30 in the Hendrickson Building, 113. That's the old theater that I think at one time was like the little theater for Juno. And it sounds like a really fun play. It includes, apparently, a naked New Year's Eve romp. I don't know how naked they get. A tacky Italian wedding and an explosive Thanksgiving dinner. And I know that this is kind of focusing on what it means to be 20-something without purpose. And these kids who are putting together this play, they're really awesome actors. And I know it's going to be a lot of fun. So I would highly recommend that. I know I'm going to definitely see it.
7:30 tonight, 7:30 Saturday, 7:30 Sunday. And these are all in the Hendrickson stage, which is...
Correct.
Maybe everyone doesn't quite know where that is on campus. There could be someone who doesn't remember.
Thank you.
So once you're in the parking lot and you've got your car parked there, where do you go?
Well, what you want to do is you're kind of parking in that upper lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
From our
out in front of where the new dormitory is going in and like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've kind of walked down the path, and then you'll see sort of a little roundabout there, and the last building on your right is the Hendrickson. The one to your left is Soboloff, and you go down the stairs.
Okay.
And then you go through the double doors and take a right, and you go all the way down the hall, and there it is.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So a little different venue than people are used to going to.
Correct.
I'm assuming it'll be signed as well.
I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and then you've got a film festival going on.
Right, yeah, and I just want to remind people.
As if there were not enough.
Yeah, right. As if there's something happening downtown tonight as well. That a lot of the faithful here, our outdoor enthusiasts, are well aware of this, but not everybody's aware of this. And this is the annual Banff Film Festival. It's a really cool thing that student government puts on every year. It's two nights at Centennial Hall. Last night it started, where they have a selection of kind of on-the-road films from the many from the Banff Film Festival that's held in the fall in Banff, Alberta. And the students select films to show in Juno. And one of the films tonight that I know I'm really excited about is called Ready to Fly. And this is an almost hour-long documentary about a woman named Lindsay Van, who has right now during this Olympics becoming the first woman one of the first women to compete in ski jumping. I mean, it's just, you know, women are got the vote how long ago, but we're finally being able to participate in ski jumping. Who knew? So, sounds like an amazing story that, you know, she's been kind of an outsider in a man's world for 18 years fighting naysayers. She was a world champion in 2010, but still she was not allowed to perform in the Vancouver Olympics 4 years ago. But now she is, and this is a film about her and her now triumph to get women in ski jumping.
What time does the band festival start?
It starts at the doors open at 6:30, and it starts at 7.
Mm-hmm.
And this is at Centennial Hall in the big room there. And there are other films as well,
yes.
You know, but that's just one that I'm aware of that I thought people might want to know about.
Okay, so the band film festival begins at 6:30 tonight, and mm-hmm. The film that we're talking about is Ready to Fly, which
right.
is one of the features that's going to be presented, but it's
right.
a whole bunch of
yeah.
films as well about
yeah.
outdoor sports, particularly winter sports and like that.
Right, but mm-hmm. I'd say the doors open at 6:30, but really, for those Junoites who happen to run late, it doesn't really start till a little bit after 7, because
yeah.
at 7 o'clock, you know, they kind of have the introductory remarks and the promotional film, and so you got a little time.
And there's ticket sales at the door
oh, yeah.
for that event. Okay,
yeah.
And Student
and
Drama Club, 7:30 tonight,
mm-hmm.
tomorrow night, and Sunday night, and then next weekend, three more performances on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
The Country Club.
The Country Club with an explosive Thanksgiving dinner. I wonder, does someone have to come in later and clean up the pieces of the turkey at the end of the
Who knows, but I'm sure it's a hoot.
I'm sure it's a hoot. Okay, hey, thank you for checking us out on all of the events that are coming up at UAS and a little bit downtown as well.
Thanks.
Katie Bosler, appreciate your coming in.
Thank you, Pat.
Here's a girl at heart, doing Girl Scouts of Alaska at our 22nd annual auction.
Enjoy refreshments from Abby's Kitchen as you bid on silent and live auction items. All proceeds benefit Girl Scouts and Southeast Alaska Camper Scholarships.
The auction will be held the evening of Saturday, February 15th at the Jack.
Adults 21 years and older will have fun at the auction.
All girls will be able to have fun at camp.
You can purchase tickets from the Jack website or at the door.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 14th of February, 2014. It is St. Valentine's Day, the day on which we celebrate love and romance, named for an early Christian priest, St. Valentine, who was martyred for his beliefs on this day in about 270 A.D. According to legend, St. Valentine fell in love with his jailer's daughter, and just before he was taken to be executed, he wrote her a love letter signed, "From Your Valentine." It was on this day, 1895, Oscar Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest, opened in London. He wrote the first draft in just 21 days. The story of Jack Worthing, who pretends to have a younger brother named Ernest, and uses that fictitious brother as an excuse for getting out of all kinds of situations, and even pretends to be Ernest when that suits his purpose. At the same time, his friend Algernon also begins impersonating Ernest, and when two women fall in love with Jack and Algernon, they both think they are in love with a man named Ernest. Oscar Wilde said that the play expressed his philosophy that we should treat all the trivial things of life very seriously and all the serious things of life with sincere and studied triviality. Oscar Wilde came to a rehearsal of the play a few days before it opened. He was wearing his green carnation and his three-piece maroon suit. He watched the actors for a few minutes, and then he said, "Yes, it is quite a good play. I remember I wrote one very like it myself, but it was even more brilliant than this." And it's the birthday of the comedian Jack Benny, born Benjamin Kubelski in Waukegan, Illinois, 1894. He was a violin prodigy, hoped to have a concert career, but by the age of 17 he was playing in vaudeville, where he learned to use the violin as a prop and to do comedy. His radio show, The Jack Benny Show, began on NBC in 1932 and ran every week for 23 years. He played a character who was stingy and sour, a terrible violinist, and perpetually 39 years old. Here's a poem for today, an old English folk song by an unknown author, poor but honest. She was poor, but she was honest, victim of the squire's whim. First he loved her, then he left her, and she lost her honest name. Then she ran away to London for to hide her grief and shame. There she met another squire, and she lost her name again. See her riding in her carriage in the park, and all so gay. All the nibs and nobby persons come to pass the time of day. See the little old-world village where her aged parents live, drinking the champagne she sends them, but they never can forgive. In the rich man's arms she flutters, like a bird with broken wing. First he loved her, then he left her, and she hasn't got a ring. See him in the splendid mansion entertaining with the best, while the girl that he has ruined entertains a sordid guest. See him in the House of Commons making laws to put down crime, while the victim of his passions trails her way through mud and slime. Standing on the bridge at midnight, she says, "Farewell, blighted love." There's a scream, a splash, good heavens! What is she a-doing of? Then they drag her from the river, water from her clothes they wrang, for they thought that she was drowned, but the corpse got up and sang. It's the same the whole world over. It's the poor that gets the blame. It's the rich that get the pleasure. Isn't it a blooming shame? Poor But Honest, a poem by an unknown author. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to, thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 23 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is going to be giving two presentations tonight at the Glacier Visitor Center. And this is part of the Fireside Lecture Program, which is held every Friday through the winter out at the Glacier Visitor Center. Tonight's presentation is going to be on Alaska's state fish, the king salmon or Chinook salmon. And the expert that's going to be talking tonight is Bill Hurd, who is a retired biologist. He was with NOAA's Auk Bay Laboratory. And in our little previous discussion, I discovered that he was with NOAA's Auk Bay Laboratory twice because it had gotten moved from one building to another. And he also spanned the period when it moved out to its current location. So, Bill, welcome, and give us a kind of an insight into what you're going to be talking about tonight.
Well, tonight's program, I call it Alaska State Fish, Chinook Salmon in Transition. And I put quotation marks around Chinook in the title, only because the state fish is, by law, defined as a king salmon. And, of course, everybody knows pretty well that Chinook and king salmon are the same. So I talk a little bit about how and why Alaska came to have a state fish. And most states, the reason we have one is that most states have one, and all states except one. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the some of the unique biology and life history of Chinook salmon. And because it's an important in the international arena, we have an important salmon treaty with Canada, and Chinook were actually the main species driver behind having a treaty with Canada. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the management and research associated with Chinook.
So, Bill, you've had an extensive career, and I'm wondering attitudes toward the fish. The fishery and the presence of fish in Southeast Alaska. You've probably watched that change among people over that long period of time that you were working in this field.
Well, I have, and the salmon in general, and amazingly, if you think about this past year, 2013, with almost 100,000 pink salmon harvested right here in Southeast, and of course, we're not going to be talking about pink salmon tonight. But back in the late 70s or late 60s, early 70s, there were only 2,000 or 3,000 pinks caught in the area. So it's come a long way, and salmon cycles go up and down, of course.
Was that because of the population or because of the fishing methods?
Well, it's a combination of factors, and like I said, salmon, we know that there are many factors that cause the populations to go up and down, and Alaska has a pretty good management system. In fact, one of the best management systems in the world. But that doesn't change the fact that the populations can fluctuate. And interestingly, when I first started, the general wisdom was that most of the fluctuations in the populations of salmon occurred in fresh water. That's because we knew a lot about biology in fresh water, and we didn't know much about the ocean. The ocean was a black box, but we assumed it was stable. We now know, after a lot of research, that the ocean conditions fluctuate a lot, and survival in the ocean fluctuates almost as much and sometimes more than it does in fresh water. So you may have very good conditions in fresh water and poor conditions in the ocean, or like this past year, we had, at least for most salmon, pinks especially, we had very good conditions in fresh water, excellent conditions in the ocean, and you know, last year, 2013, was an all-time record commercial harvest of salmon throughout the state. Having said that, our subject of tonight's talk, the Chinook and King salmon, are at the very bottom of the list because their populations have gone down at the same time some of the other species have gone up. And we don't fully understand that why. And you may recall that it's a statewide issue, and the Morse Communications Network recently published in the Juneau Empire and other outlets around the state a 10-week series on conserving the Kenai King. Mm-hmm. And there's a great deal of controversy now about the general health of Chinook or King salmon in many parts of the state, including here in Southeast. Our runs are down, but they're not down nearly as much as some other areas. The two big, what I call 900-pound gorillas, are the Yukon River and the Kenai River in Cook Inlet. And those are both highly contentious and controversial. A lot of issues between different user groups and allocation of a very limited resource.
And this is the way you're going to develop your theme tonight.
I'm going to be talking about that and some of the reasons. As I said, many of these things we don't fully understand. In fact, in 2012, the state put on a major symposium in Anchorage on Chinook salmon, trying to find out, you know, why the populations have gone down, and the ADF&G staff did a very good detailed gap analysis of a lot of the unknowns around the state, and have now developed a new research plan, which the governor is supporting, and there's new funds for that. And they're going to be bearing down and focusing on a lot of the unknown areas of the biology, both in freshwater and the marine environment.
That I want to go back to something that you said before, and that was when you started out, the ocean side of the fish life cycle was basically a black box. What was it that changed? How were we able to conduct research that gave us more knowledge about?
Well, there's been ocean research going on for a long time. First of all, it's very expensive, particularly big ships getting out into the open ocean. There's been a lot of work in recent years, the last couple of decades, on the nearshore ocean environment, which is very important. And our lab at Auk Bay has been kind of a pioneer in that work here in Alaska. And so we think that this early marine period, when the young salmon from freshwater first get into the ocean, is a critical time. And much of the mortality that occurs in the ocean may be occurring in that those first few weeks or even months when they're in the ocean.
And that mortality is caused by?
It can be caused by predators. It can be caused by lack of food in terms of maybe the plankton bloom is late for one reason or another, and the timing of the fish coming out of fresh water may be influenced now with global warming and changing For example, we have research at Auk Creek, where we have a research station there, the lab has, and we know now that over the last 30 years, there's been significant changes in the out-migration timing of young salmon coming out of Auk Creek because of warming temperatures. You know, just a few degrees, fractions of degrees, can influence the fish behavior, the phenology of how they behave.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating subject matter. Something everyone in Southeast Alaska needs to be aware of because it's such a major component of our economy down here, as well as being a source of wonderful sport fishing opportunities and like
well,
that.
Well, salmon are also important to the whole ecology of the area. If you think about, you know, the whole Tongass Forest and the fact that salmon bring all those ocean nutrients, like last year, we got a big influx, as it were, of good nutrients from the ocean coming into our streams throughout Southeast. And so that's an important, ecologically, they're just an important part of the whole ecosystem.
Sounds like this is going to be a fascinating discussion tonight. So the fireside lecture format is basically Bill will be doing his talk at 6:30. And
that's
then there'll be a question and answer session to follow, and then the theater can empty out, and anyone who wants to stay to see it all again can do that. But at 8 o'clock, it's a repeat of the same program. So if you come at 6:30 or if you come at 8, you get the whole show with Bill Hurd talking about Alaska's state fish, the Chinook salmon, in transition. Bill, I hope you bring in a big crowd and teach folks a lot about our state fish.
Well, we'll try, and Laurie Craig does a great job of hosting those fireside programs.
This is one of the best things that goes on in the winter around here. Those fireside lectures are always fascinating. Thank you so much for putting one on, and thanks for coming down and tell us about it.
Thank you.
It's about 11 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. The music in the background is the music of the Panhandle Crabgrass Revival Band, but it's also the music of Rumblefish. If you take away one and add two and crisscross three and then multiply by four. And with me is one of the members of Rumblefish, Sergei Morosin, is here.
Yeah.
And, Sergei, you guys are doing a kind of a repeat of something that was really popularly received last year when you did it. And this is The series that has gone on for several years now at our own little Gold Town Theater, and that is having local music groups put music up behind silent films. And this one is The General, which is an amazing piece of film footage with Charlie Chaplin and
Buster Keaton.
Buster Keaton, sorry, yeah. Buster Keaton. And you guys working the stage alongside the film and working to the film.
Yeah. Yeah, this is something that Colette, she came up with it, I don't know, probably 3 years ago, and I know that several groups around town have done this done this film series before. She calls it the Not So Silent Film Series, and she approached us about doing one and hummed and hawed about, you know, a good film to kind of, to fit our music. We play Appalachian string band music, also known as old time or old timey or whatever you want to call it, but that's what we play. And so, and that, the history of that music actually goes back to the Civil War, which is where The General takes place. And so it just became a perfect fit. And, once we got into it, we just had a ball putting it together, and we, yeah, we've done five shows in the last year. We did some in November, and then we rehashed it and did a couple more shows in January, and then that was it. So someone approached us about playing it for their wedding, which is tonight, which is obviously a private event. But then so we said, well, if we're going to go through all the trouble of bringing our gear down there and getting set up, might as well do a couple more. And one way I thought about it was, there's only, we had pretty full houses. We've done five shows. We had pretty full houses. So let's average 70 people a house, 70 people per show. That's 350 people. That's just over 1% of the population in Juneau who has seen this. So there's a large swath of people to come pack in there the next two shows.
So the shows are at 2 o'clock and 9 p.m. on Saturday.
4 p.m.
4. Yeah. Okay, I got the wrong time here.
Okay,
so 2 and 4 p.m. on Saturday, that's the 19th, and that's the Downtown Theater. If you don't know where it is, it's down behind the Emporium Mall. Mm-hmm. It's behind Heritage Coffee in there at the Gold Town Theater.
So let's see, 4 p.m. and 9 p.m.
Oh, 4 and 9.
Yeah.
Okay. So, totally wrong times. All right. Good.
It's a great... Okay. And I'll just say, it's awesome for the family. Like, we've done 4 o'clock shows before, and the kids come, and they just have a hoot. I get to see the whole audience from where I'm standing playing, and I was just seeing kids bellied over laughing, and it's just a great old time, so...
Sergey, you used the phrase of you put it together. Could you describe the process of finding the music in the movie?
Yeah, so we watched it a couple times, the four of us. And then our fiddler, Andy Ferguson, he started spending some time with it. And so in old-time music, the fiddle leads everything. The fiddle is the main melody instrument, and so the fiddler usually calls the tunes, and then we have a bass, guitar, and a banjo. And so so the fiddler calls the tunes, and so what Andy did was he kind of mapped out, he watched the movie and mapped out where he thought certain tunes that he knew, and that we all know, but that he knew could fit into the movie. And so that was you could call that a rough outline. And so then we all got back together again, and that's when the gears really started turning, and we're like, oh, well, yeah, and so from there we should go into this tune, and you know, all these tunes have been around forever, they're really old tunes, and they all have a different feel to them, even though they're all instrumental. You know, some are happy, some are pretty lonesome, and you could just tell by the, you know, the tones that are being brought through the music. And so we kind of did some of that, and then we definitely put some gag tunes in, just kind of tunes that everyone would relate to, and they definitely, just from hearing the audience's reaction, you can tell that worked. You know, well, for example, we used the there's a couple scenes where we use the Pink Panther theme that Eric yeah. gets. He plays, actually plays that on the clarinet, and then we have some sound effects, whistles and thunder and all that. So it's kind of a start out with Andy mapping it out, and then it became a very collaborative process after that. So I guess
about scene length.
Mm-hmm.
Songs and scenes aren't the same length. So, how do you go about adapting? What's the trick?
Well, I think one of the reasons that really made this film work was that I'd say 80% of it is a train scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so you have all these things happening, but it's all fast motion. It's all, the train is moving and people are chasing and shooting off cannons and falling off the train and throwing logs. And so a lot of it was stringing, putting a string of tunes together that just kind of worked with what the action that was happening. As far as other scenes, when you say songs, I will switch the term to tunes, because since there's no singing in it, we're able to start and stop mm-hmm. wherever we want. And we just kind of make that happen. It just became something we memorized. Though we did chart it out. We have it charted out so that you can, it says, you know, this, you know, Love is Pleasing is the name of the tune, and it starts when he's, you know, just a little cue. And so that's kind of the scene that, or the way we did that, yeah.
And then you're looking, have you changed it in response to the audience reaction?
Not too much. We got a really good reaction, and we thought there's just...
No, this works.
This works. Don't,
don't,
you know, don't leave a good time to go have a good time.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Okay, so the shows are, and let's do this right this time.
All right.
The shows are at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And 9 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Yep.
And these two shows are The General, which was filmed in 1926. Wonderful Civil War era movie with Buster Keaton.
In the top 20 of all films ever made.
Ever made,
little
yes.
tidbit
okay,
of
and the background music is going to be Rumblefish. Let's see. Rumblefish is Jack Fontanella, Eric Chadwell, Sergey, who's with us here, and Andy Ferguson. Anybody
That's
else joining in? Or?
Nope, all, just okay. four of us.
All right, good enough. And this is all at the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. So
yeah.
Come on down and get a look at it.
All right.
And get a listen to it, too.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Pat.
You bet.
Tonight on 360 North at 8 o'clock, state legislators address issues of interest to the general community and Alaska Natives in particular at the Native Issues Forum. At 9 o'clock, it's Global Leaders, the Next Generation. Gavel Alaska's legislative coverage returns at 10, tonight on 360 North and 360north.org. Watch the Juno Roller Girls live on Saturday at 7 p.m. Follow 360 North on Facebook and Twitter.
This is Bird Note.
If I can help falling in love with you.
This is Cupid's busiest day of the year. You could say that love is in the air. And for some birds, you can take that literally. Love really is in the air. Consider the birds called white-throated swifts. White-throated swifts are sparrow-sized birds with short bodies and very long, slender wings. They nest in canyons throughout the West. When a pair of white-throated swifts wants to get to know each other better, they meet up, on the wing, high above the ground. The two birds then grasp one another and, clinging together, tumble downward, their bodies whirling in space. Still locked in this embrace, the swifts may plummet for over 500 feet until, just before striking the earth, they separate. Then they flap nonchalantly back up the canyon wall. This behavior, known as a courtship fall, helps bond the two swifts as a pair for the nesting season. Some observers suspect that white-throated swifts may even mate during their rapid joint descent. Visit a western canyon this spring and you might see firsthand a pair of swifts literally falling in love.
If I can't help falling in love with
you're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juneau Afternoon. This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. We're on GCI Cable 871 here in Juneau. Time now for All Things Considered.